This is a Steam Studio production.
Welcome to the Steam Spotlight, where we celebrate the inspiring achievements of students, educators, and community partners making waves in the STEAM field.
For today's STEAM Studio Spotlight, we are excited to welcome Dr. Jared Adelman, a physicist and professor at Northern Illinois University. Now, through Professor Adelman's experiences, he has become a gifted explainer of complex science. Professor Adelman's a key researcher on the ATLAS experiment at CERN's Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, where he studies the universe at its smallest scales. But whether Professor Adelman is discussing new particle discoveries or the science of skiing downhill, Professor Adelman has a unique talent for making the intricate details accessible to everyone.
Well, Jared, welcome so much to the STEAM Studio. We're excited to have you here so we can talk to you a little bit about you and what you do.
Great. I'm happy to be here.
So can you start off by telling us a little bit about who you are and what do you do here at NIU?
So I've been at NIU for a bit over a decade. I'm a professor in the Department of Physics. My research area is particle physics. So if you ask me what I'm doing at any one given moment in time, if I'm not with students or teaching, I'm most likely doing something related to particle physics. And in particular, the experiment that I work on and have worked on since before I came to NIU is the ATLAS experiment, which is one of these huge, huge, huge mega experiments over at CERN. So CERN is the particle physics laboratory in Europe. So it's sort of a counterpart for those in the US, especially around NIU, may be familiar with Fermilab. And so CERN is sort of the European version of that.
Well, great. That stuff's fascinating. To me, that just seems like magic. Like this whole idea of particle physics. And like, I just can't think that small.
That was the same reaction I had, Kristen. I'm like, well, great. That sounds amazing that you do that.
It sounds like magic and feels like magic because we're used to understanding our world with the senses that we have, right? We like to understand things that we can pick up. We like to understand things we can hear or see or touch. Perhaps taste in physics, we try to get away from,
don't lick things in science.
Exactly. And smell also. That's why it often is unfamiliar because our bodies are not used to dealing with things that small in the quantum sort of realm or world, or even smaller than atomic stuff, right?
Right. Yeah. So how did you get into this then?
I went to university and I don't know, maybe I was a very boring high school student and decided I was going to be an engineer. And I was going to be a chemical engineer because I like chemistry. And someone told me you can get a good job in chemical engineering. And I think that is a very true statement, was then, yes. And it is true now, right? And with all due respect to the engineers at NIU and elsewhere, the main class that I teach at NIU is Introduction to Physics with mostly engineers. So work with almost all engineers that these days come through NIU have been in my class. The intro class that I took at university for engineering was understanding the braking system on a bicycle. And as someone who likes to bike, and as many people who do, it's very, very, very important. And I found this to be very boring. I just couldn't get that excited by the braking system on a bicycle. So then I decided I was going to be a chemist because I liked chemistry. And I was going to be a physical chemist because I also happened to be interested in physics. And I think outside of the engineers, the number one, two major in my class, the intro physics class, are chemists. So with all due respect to the chemists, I thought I was going to be a great chemist. And then I had to take organic chemistry.
Yeah,
and that didn't go well. It was the closest I came to failing a class at university. And we had actually an instructor who only was responsible for the labs. And I was just could not get stuff done. And in particular, we had to pull micropipettes. So basically what you had to do, for those who don't know this, is you would take a pipette, which is like a small thing of glass, and you wanted to make it even smaller on the bottom. So you put it over a Bunsen burner, some flame, and it would get hot. And once it's hot, you could actually pull it, right, and stretch it so it would be very, very, very small. One thing that an aspiring physicist at the time, or even a chemist, should realize is that glass doesn't conduct heat. And I wasn't having any success this day. And the you know, professor in the lab came over and said, "Can I take a look? What's going wrong?" I said, "Sure." And he said, "Is it hot?" And I said, "No," because the part that I was holding was not hot. And I gave it to him. And then he touched it. And then he screamed and dropped it.
It was
very, very hot. He did not fail me for that. But I think I concluded that chemistry was not for me. And then I happened to be taking physics at the time and started really enjoying it. And there was someone at the university who said, "Hey, I'm looking for some undergraduates to work on particle physics, to do some simple things at D0, which was an experiment running at the Tevatron, which was at Fermilab." And I said, "Oh, this sounds fun." And it involved computers, which I also really, really liked. And I sort of never looked back, basically. So that's how I got into particle physics.
Well, and I love that, because so many times I think a lot of our high school students or our middle school students think that they have to decide what they want to be in when they grow up, and they go and do that. And I know I had a similar experience where I started in one thing and then took this class at college, and it's like, that was interesting, but then it wasn't, and it wasn't that. Like, so many of us find our paths and find our passions in college because we weren't exposed to some of these things before.
Yeah, and absolutely. And the thing that really got me specifically into particle physics was just a professor, a faculty member saying, "Hey, I have a chance for a student to work with me. Would you like to be that student?" And he was just, you know, giving me a chance. He didn't know that I would do much of anything, but like, that's what students really should be doing, is reaching out and finding faculty to work with, to meet with, to talk to, right? That's how you get involved in things. Because even if you think you know what you want to do, there's a good chance you don't really understand what it involves until you get knee deep into it, right? For research or a job, an occupation, whatever it is. So getting involved in whatever that means is important, right? So that's how I got started.
So what does research look like for you? Like, so you said you're working on some, like, what are you researching within the particle physics realm?
Right. So, right, particle physics is trying to understand the smallest particles, right? The smallest things in the universe. So in general, that's what you would say physicists want to do, is understand the world around us, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's true of a lot of the sciences, but we in physics try and understand the world at the most basic level. So what we mean are being able to write down some equations or write down some laws or some theories or some explanations that then can't be broken down into sort of smaller things. And sort of if you take that to an extreme, particle physics is really the extreme of that. We want to understand the building blocks of everything in the universe, everything around us at the most basic level. So I want to find out what something is made of, and I don't want to find the pieces that can be broken in half. I want to find the pieces that we can't break in half. Right. And there's this grand tradition of this in science and physics. If you think back to the Greeks, right, the periodic table has a bunch of atoms on there. Right. And that was named for the atomists, who said we want to understand the smallest things in around us. Right. Now, atoms are not the basic building blocks of nature. Right. That we can, in particle physics, we know that atoms are made of smaller pieces. But there's this grand tradition of doing that. Right. So that's what particle physics does. And for the longest time, you could do this by sort of taking things apart or by shining light on something, right? That's how we understand, right? You said you want to see what you like to see what you're studying,
mm-hmm.
by shining light on it. But at some point that breaks down, and that breaks down because the smaller something is that you want to see, the more energetic the light has to be. So the physics nerdy thing would say that you need something that has a wavelength that's roughly the same size of the object you want to see. So okay. Very, very wavelength light, very high frequency, very, very energetic. So A, it's hard to actually find some, you know, light that is that energetic, and B, you end up just breaking stuff apart, right? You don't really study it. So in particle physics, we've come up with a second approach, which is to take small things, maybe not the smallest things you can think of, but very small things, and smash them into one another. the reason we do that is that we have, right, the most famous formula in all of physics, perhaps, E equals mc squared. And so if you take a lot of energy and you put it in a very, very small space, you can convert that to matter and potentially to different forms of matter, new forms of matter. And in doing so, you can study these laws of physics at these very, very small distances. So that is what the LHC, which is the collider at CERN, the lab where this is, does. It takes most of the protons and circulates them one way, and protons circulate them the other way. There's this ring that's 16 miles or 27 kilometers around and smashes them together at a bunch of different points. And my experiment basically surrounds one of those points. So that's what the ATLAS experiment is basically a giant digital camera that's taking a bunch of pictures of what comes out of collisions of a bunch of protons smashing into each other 40 million times a second. And so that is what how the research works. What we study are the basic laws of physics. We have a theory for that, the standard model of physics, and it makes predictions for how often things occur, with what energies they occur, what kinds of objects get produced with other kinds of objects, and we compare our observation to those predictions and look to see if maybe the predictions are not quite right.
I always love looking at the images that come off of those because they're really beautiful.
Yeah, we have very nice event displays. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you like to see your science, exactly.
I do, you do. I like to see. That's why the physics for me that made the most sense is if I'm, launching something big and I could see where it's going to go and predict where it's going to go.
So you're a fan of the pumpkin trebuchet.
Yeah, I have an engineering background, so that kind of probably explains it.
I saw that and got very excited. I couldn't make it out to see it.
I know. I think that's some of the things that get people excited because they can see it. And then it's about how do you explain why it's happening the way it's happening. And, I think that's what's kind of exciting about just science in general is you're trying to just explain why does it do, even looking at the pictures you look at, you're trying to explain what you're seeing, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you've probably are dealing with a lot of data. So is it visual data? Is it computer data? And then how is technology helping you explore that data? Has that changed since you've been in the field?
So it is a huge amount of data. Enormous quantities of data. We have the data from the experiment, but it's hard to think of a case where we don't. The way we actually make measurements and look for things is by comparing the data to simulations. So we have the theory that we simulate, and then we compare the data to the simulation. So we actually have huge amounts of data, huge amounts of simulation, right? We're sort of approaching insane amounts of data that we have to store across the globe, that we produce, that we have to run over. So it's occasionally for rare things, we're looking visually to see what went maybe wrong. But for the most part, most of what we do is big, right? That we were sort of one of the originators of the sort of, big data science sort of era. Mm-hmm. And up until very recently, when the economy seems to have dropped most jobs in data science and computer science and pretty much everywhere, that was for the most part what most people who graduated with, a degree in particle physics, a PhD with particle physics analysis would be go do data science, because that's basically what our analyses are, is sorting through huge amounts of data to understand what we see. And so that has changed tremendously since I started in this field. So when I started as a grad student, the field had recently made a change, we can be a little geeky, to teaching everyone to use C++. And yeah. Object-oriented programming and C++. And the reason for that was that this was the future of computing and everyone was going to get jobs in telecommunications and finance and banking doing all of this. Now, it turns out, I think there's been a realization, not just in physics, but elsewhere, that object-oriented programming is a very, very nice thing in some cases, but overwhelmingly, in many cases, can just really confuse what you're doing. So C++ also is good because it was fast, efficient, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to run through lots of data, you want to write code quickly, it was useful for that. Over the past, 5-ish years, going back even a bit further than that, but especially in the past 5 years, the field has really moved to using other tools. The common programming language for most data analysis these days is Python. If you're a computer geek, you might know these sorts of things. But even then, using Python is much easier to follow, but is very easy to do very poorly. And so there's been a lot of emphasis to understand develop the technology to actually use Python efficiently for huge data sets. Because what is done in industry and what particle physicists had done traditionally didn't really match up. And so there's been a lot of work there. For technology, there's been a lot of work in computers also, if you're talking about big data, to use what are called accelerators. So if you're a gamer, you have a laptop or a computer that has a bunch of GPUs that let it do run computer graphics very efficiently. And so, you know, you have somebody that is exploring in some fantasy world and you move forwards, right? And the computer has to figure out what the new world looks like. And that turns out that figuring out all those computer graphics is a bunch of very simple operations on vectors and matrices over and over and over and over again. So these special chips, GPUs, were very, very good at that. And so there's been a push in the field to make use of that for our work, and there's some progress there. And I actually spend a lot of time thinking about how to use other kinds of accelerators, which are called FPGAs, which are a little more closer to like electronic circuits, but have very, very special good uses. So FPGAs are often in things like telecommunications, in cars. My printer always wants to update the code for the it's called firmware for FPGA. And it's, if you've ever seen a printer saying, would you like to download the latest firmware? That's for a special chip called an FPGA. And that's sort of what I've spent the past few years trying to figure out how best to use in the field. So the latest, newest computing technologies. Most of the use of FPGAs these days are for people in finance. And we try not to think about that because they've learned that if they can do trading like a tiny, tiny fraction of a second faster than people across the street, they can make money that way. And we're using it hopefully for better purposes, but that's the biggest use case for these things is just strange financial trading things.
It's interesting how all of that is kind of interconnected. And so you really did, when you said you particle physics was something that was really interesting to you, but so was computers. That really plays a big role in helping you do the work you do.
Yeah, I mean, it is a big role for everyone in our field. But in particular, so at NIU, I run this, we call it a traineeship, but it's basically a program for graduate students. So for 2 years, they get special funding and take some special courses, and they work with people at Argonne and Fermilab, right? That's if you ask why NIU physics has got any right to be any good, the reason is our closeness to those two national labs, right? We have joint faculty, we work closely with them, our students go there. And so we pair our students with people, right, research scientists and specialists at the labs to study sort of cutting edge computation and software and computing and learn those skills, because I think there's a realization that we actually need to do research in software and computing and not just use it, but actually like improve the tools and develop new tools. So we have many students in our department who are doing this. This is a traineeship we have joint with UIC down the road.
Okay. I think it is interesting how many people don't realize how close and how lucky we are to have two national labs in our backyard. There's how many national labs across the country? Is it...
I forget the number.
I forget the number offhand, but it's not a lot. Like, no. For Illinois to have two of them this close to us, it really is amazing what opportunities that provides for our NIU faculty and students.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So, you know, I think the strongest thing about our department, which I don't directly work on, are our beam and accelerator physics programs. So these are the people who actually accelerate the protons and smash them together for us at CERN. But they do things like if you have any radiation therapy, you have a part of, you know, you could potentially have a mini particle accelerator that shoots protons or x-rays or other things at your body. If you have imaging, right, you have to generate those x-rays somewhere. But there's all sorts of industrial applications for people like this as well. And there's really not that many places in the U.S. where students are trained in this, and one of the best in the U.S. is, or if not the world, really, is at NIU because I think of proximity to both Argonne and Fermilab.
That's cool. That actually takes, like, we could do a whole nother, I'd love to learn more about, like, when people think about careers in particle physics or just careers in physics, they're probably thinking very limited. There's probably a lot of different directions that people can go with this kind of background and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Right. I mean, we said these days it's hard to get jobs doing anything, yeah. I think, but, but physicists tend to find, you know, jobs at labs, working for big companies, working as engineers, working with computers, working with big data, doing machine learning, all sorts of things. Plus, the simplest is the wrong word, but perhaps the one that's easiest to forget is actually just teaching physics, mm-hmm. right? And we have a good program in science education at NIU, and that includes in physics as well.
When a lot of our physics teachers do research, like they've done research, like we train them as mm-hmm. physicists mm-hmm. and then also teach them the pedagogy on how to then teach it, which I think I don't think a lot of people understand when our secondary educators, they go through the program that they do physics.
Yeah, it's great to see those. I'm having, you know, been on like, you know, thesis committees for, you know, people who are then teaching high school students physics, right? And they're actually doing real research. But they do research at NIU, both in actual core physics research, but we also have a program in physics education. You can do research in how to teach, which is kind of a cool thing.
It's kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jared, was there something in your career, specifically within physics, that you were surprised by, like that you had to do, or something that, like, so if someone's saying, I want to do physics, I want to work in this one, was there something like, I honestly did not know I needed to know that, or I needed to be prepared for that? And for our listeners, there are 17 national laboratories in the United States.
I was going to say 19.
Thanks to the U.S. Department of Energy, that is their source. Right. I'm citing them.
I had 19 in my head. I was so close.
I thought it was a little more than that, so I was definitely wrong. But we have 2 of 19. That's pretty, impressive. So, you know, that's really sort of changed over time. Mm-hmm. When I was a grad student, I think the thing that nobody prepared me for as I was sort of finishing up, and this I think is true not just as a grad student, but in physics, but anywhere, right, when you have a graduate degree, no one really told me how much I needed organizational skills. and so, you know, you're trying to finish an analysis and work with colleagues and have meetings and do all these other things. And at some point I realized, like, wow, I really need to start, you know, not like a lab notebook is great, but I really need to also have just a to-do list, right? Why did nobody tell me this? And of course now, you know, I have a family and, you know, I'm teaching and doing research and other things. So like, it's obvious to me now, but at the time, like no one told me that. And at some point I just realized it. So, you know, as a grad student, that really caught me off guard. So, and I think it's a useful life skill that, you know, even undergraduates probably, you know, often miss out on. And I don't know how to, right? I don't know where that someone is supposed to tell you that, right? Like when I was an undergraduate, I didn't have a to-do list. I just was like, you know, oh, I guess this is coming up soon and thinking about things, right? At some point you realize like you got to write this stuff down and have a calendar, right? you know, so that really was a, I don't know, life-changing, maybe not, but like it really changed my ability to get stuff done, right? And then, you know, when I became, you know, the postdoc that continued now as a faculty member, the interesting thing, you know, one of the things, I'll say it in the good way and then the negative way after. So one of the things I really like about what I do is that I don't do the same thing all the time, right? So we do a lot of stuff with computers, but there's a lot of stuff with all kinds of computer tools and very, very different computational tools. Some of it, you know, we do for analysis machine learning. Some of it is the basic data science. I'm dealing with these new accelerators. In particle physics, we're in a lot of meetings. I'm working with students as undergraduates. I'm working with students that are graduate students. I'm helping postdocs find positions, right? So like every day is different and I love that. That's great. One of the things that we do a lot once you get further in the field is spreadsheets, right? And nobody tells you that, even though it should be obvious that you have to do that. You're going to have grants and you have to track where that money is going. You're going to be running groups where you manage money of a dozen, you know, controlling for funds for a dozen different people. And you have to figure out where that money is going and that sort of thing. And so that's one of the less glamorous things about this. I don't think it's just in physics, but the further you progress, the further you get away from the actual science sometimes, you know, instead you're managing a group, right? Which is okay, right? There's benefits and pleasures and joys in that as well. But it changes, right? You get told like, oh, you're gonna be changing what you do the further you progress. You're like, no, I'm always going to be able to do an analysis to sit down. And I still can, but it's every year I do less and less of that and more of writing grants and dealing with spreadsheets and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That idea that your career evolves constantly. And some of that too is how do you help it move forward and like looking for those opportunities of, oh, I can do this, but oh, I can also do this over here. That's a similar skill set. So it's, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's, as you said, a lot of undergrads or a lot of early folks in their career don't realize how much their career will change over the course of their lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Yeah. And that's fun. That's good.
It is. It's fun. It keeps it, as you said, it keeps it interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I'm wondering real fast, Kristen.
No, go ahead.
I'm wondering because for those that might not be involved in physics, I feel like when we're talking about our national laboratories, when we're talking about CERN, like these are human accomplishments. These are like massive things that we as humanity have created and are revered is really what I'm trying to get to. For you, as someone who is working with in those places in your career, you're in the MBA, you're there, you're doing that. Is there something that you still would like to experience? Is there something that you're like, I would like to work at this laboratory, I would like to go here, I would like to research? Is there something that you're still like, ooh, that would be cool? Or are you like, no, I'm just amazed and I'm happy I'm where I'm at?
Well, so I mean, it's a fair question. So you sort of talk about these man-made, these huge things, these objects, right? These experiments are big. They're big in many ways. One of them is just sheer size, right? So, right, our experiment, right? We said the LHC, so not even my experiment, just sort of, 27 kilometers, 60 miles, around. The experiment that actually sort of takes these pictures, the Atlas, is, many tens of meters across and many tens of meters of highs and, thousands of tons, right? Big, right? Like it's huge. So they're big in sheer size. They're big in terms of author list. So I have, the papers are like thousands of authors, right? Because it takes that many people to do all the stuff in science that come out of it. They're also, though, really big in terms of time scales. So, so I joined this experiment in 2008 as a postdoc. Then I was there, but we weren't taking data because there was issues. So this is going back almost 2 decades when the LHC tried to turn on, there were problems, right? And basically a lot of stuff had to be redone because of challenges in the construction, let's say. And so that delayed things a few years. But then after a few years, it did start up. The LHC has since progressed in energy. So the collisions have more energy. The protons that we're colliding are more energetic. But we also are collecting more data. So when I started at NIU, we had sort of a certain amount of data that we had collected, even forgetting the energy. And now Atlas has recorded more than an order of magnitude, so more than a factor of 10 more data compared to sort of then. However, if you look for the next sort of 15, 20 year time scale, we expect to collect between 5 and 10 times more data overall. So there's going to be upgrades to the accelerator. When I talked about these sort of new computer tools, these accelerators that I work on, they're to for that upgrade, because we have to deal with the fact that we have so much stuff in the detector because there's collisions, so many collisions occurring. So I would love to see that sort of project come to fruition and completion, but there's so much data that we still haven't that we haven't collected yet that we are going to, that it's sort of, right, it's exciting that, you know, you could sort of look towards the end of my future, you know, as a, you know, when I'm getting close to retirement, and we'll still be looking at analyses, right, you know, and doing analyses with that data set. So there's very, very long time scales. There are plans in Europe and in the US to try and think about what the next sort of accelerator is going to be. The challenge is that under the, even the most realistic of these things, right, like I will only play a very, very small incremental role at best in any of them, because they are, take so long to construct these things and take so long to build them and the technology to progress, right? So that's okay. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, right? There's a lot of new analyses, a lot of new tools that we're working on our experiment, and that's okay.
You're trying to answer big questions with like with lots of data and takes lots of time.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it is strange, you know, it's to think that, you know, you're just going to spend like most of your career like on doing one experiment. But that one experiment has tons of technologies. Like we've published over 1,000 papers, isn't it, collaboration? Wow. Right. So like it's not like we're just sitting around redoing the same thing, twiddling our thumbs. Right. So we're always, there's new things to work on and new things to do. Yeah.
When I think what the way you talked about how collaborative it is, I think that's another misperception, is that scientists kind of work in their lab by themselves, but there's a lot of people that are involved in these experiments and making this happen. Everything from the, you know, how do we build the equipment to actually answer the questions you're trying to answer, to run the experiment, look at the data. This, you said thousands of people on articles. That's
so
crazy.
You know, when I started in this field, I would say, oh, yeah, like the particle physicists have, you know, like when I started, it was many, many hundreds, you know, on the Tevatron experiments. And, you know, we do the big science with the big collaborations. And like, you can go look at the people who, you know, have their, you know, their own experiments, and they work with like, you know, three people, you know, papers that have three people. But even then, that is becoming more rare, right? Even like what you used to think of someone setting up an experiment on their tabletop, and then sort of, you know, them and their grad students, and that was it, and they would publish a paper. These days, people have collaborators within an institution, across departments. They have collaborators between, you know, across colleges at the same institution. They have collaborators with other universities. They have collaborators across the globe, collaborators at the national lab. Sometimes they take their data to the big experiments, like Argonne has the APS, the Advanced Photon Source. So even if you're doing a small tabletop experiment, you want to study the properties of this material, you might be part of a much bigger group that gets beam time for, you know, 1 week a year to go work on this big, you know, a tight collect, you know, the data taking will be for your experiment, right? But you're working with a lot of other people, right? And so it really is an era of collaboration, right, in science, which is good and bad, right? I mean, it's overall good. It leads to meetings, which is
lots of meetings. Which, that's another skill as, you know, adult career is you've got to learn how to do and be productive in meetings.
Be productive, but also to present, right? So I often tell students that if they want to progress in particle physics, you know, aside from learning all the skills we teach them and the physics, they actually have to be really good at communication. So maybe it gets back to the other question, Russ, right? Communication is key and important, and not everyone is good at that. It takes practice to become good and proficient at it.
Now, from the communication perspective, I think it's, there's one thing of communicating with other scientists that know what you're talking about, but then there's communicating with the rest of us. Like, those are two very different skill sets.
Oh, yeah. Very much so, right? You know, the communicating with your peers in some sense is easier, right? Because you use the language that you are used to using, right? So when I teach intro physics, right, I begin the intro physics by explaining that even in, you know, physics one, where we're teaching basic classical mechanics, like, you know, balls rolling down ramps, you know, that sort of thing, the language we use is not the same that they use in everyday communication and conversation, right? And so even then, you have to be careful about the language we use, right? So like, you know, in intro physics, for those of you know, okay, hopefully, you know, Kristen, you remember your intro physics days, yeah. You know? right? So it's easy to get problems wrong if you're messing up velocity and speed. In physics, they have very clear meanings. Or what's the other one? Well, velocity and speed are the most common one, but energy is one that has a very specific meaning in physics that doesn't have the same meaning sort of elsewhere. Oh, the other common one is mass and weight, right?
Yeah.
Mass and weight are different things, right? You go to your doctor, he says he's going to measure your, right? He would use them. He'd say, hey, this is how, you know, your mass or your weight, but those are very, very different things in physics, right?
Yeah.
If you use the wrong one, you get the wrong answer on the exam, right? So even then, language is important. So when you're talking to the general public, it becomes harder to figure out the language that everyone else understands that also is, you know, close to correct in terms of the science, right? So,
which actually leads us to, at the time of this recording, when we're talking right now, we are starting to set up your STEAM Cafe, which is just that. How do we talk about physics with a general population? But what I'm really excited about is the topic that you're using to explain physics. So you're going to talk to us about the physics of the Olympics, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the plan, at least.
So how do you go from particle physics to, all right, now we're looking at the physics that maybe many of us are more familiar with because we've had it in high school or we've had it in college. So what are some of the things that you would talk about or we could expect to hear you talk about in the upcoming STEM Cafe?
So I try and use this when I teach intro physics because students get tired of balls rolling down ramps, right? You know, it's an important thing to study, right?
But
you know,
it is.
Yeah. But, you know, if you look at one of the sort of where can we use the language and tools from very introductory physics, you don't need calculus, you don't need advanced topics. Where can you use simple ideas to maybe shed some light or offer a unique perspective on what you see in the everyday world, right? And basic intro mechanics is things moving. So what is it that, you know, where can we study things moving? And sporting world is one obvious place where things move from point A to point B, they change direction, they accelerate, things take a certain amount of time and you're interested in going as quickly as possible. So that is, you know, a great place to explore sort of introductory physics. So it's not particle physics, but as I tell the students in the intro class, right, physics builds upon physics, right? So particle physics didn't sort of come out of the blue, but it came from trying to understand everything around us and the world around us. And most of the basic introductory mechanics is science that is a few hundred years old. I show a picture. I went in the intro class. I explained that most of introductory mechanics was studied by a bunch of, what is the phrase I use? Stuffy old white dudes. and I think that is generally true. And they had the weird, you know, you look at the pictures of Isaac Newton, he had the weird wig and, you know, Robert Hooke, and you know, it was a look, it was a thing. they lended themselves to being stuffy and, you know, they tended to have these, right, they were posing for portraits, so they had like the big robes and whatever else, right? They tried to
very look academic. It was very academic.
Yes, exactly. And so it's old physics, old science, but that's where this started from. And they were trying to understand the world around them too. They didn't have the tools of the LHC to understand nature at the smallest distance scales. They were just trying to understand balls rolling down ramps, because that was something they could study and they could set up that experiment, right? That was the tools that they had, those were the tools they had available to them. So it starts from the same tradition of trying to understand things, basically.
From balls rolling down a hill to ski jumpers jumping off of ski ramps to the luge. I think my favorite is just thinking about the physics involved in ice skating. Like the spinning and the way we've been able to do, we, as in like I'm an ice skater, not we, they have been able to do the higher, bigger jumps than, like, just understanding the physics behind how that's possible is super cool.
Yeah. So the figure skaters, the most fun thing to just talk about figure skaters is right when they are spinning and they speed up and slow down. And for those who came to STEMFest, and, you know, it went very, very well, but maybe the two of you are still recovering. I don't know. It takes you 10 months to recover. I'm not sure how long. If you came to the physics booth and not the fancy haunted STEM, you know, area that Jeremy was setting up, but the actual physics table, which was had many fewer things. And I was there with my son, and we have the spinning chair with the weight. And so, you know, you can do this at home, right? You can, if you have a good spinning chair that doesn't, you know, is well oiled, you can get someone to spin you around and you take a bunch of weights and you hold them into your body and then you bring them out and then you slow down, you bring them in and you speed up. And this is a, right, a conservation of angular momentum, right? And we talk about this in intro physics, and it, right, that's all it is. And that's, you know, they spread out their mass further from their rotation axis. So that's why they stick their arms and legs out. And then they slow down and then they bring their bodies in, they tuck themselves in and they speed up. Unfortunately, I don't think it works as well. Maybe there, you can see it a little bit in the Winter Olympics, but the most exciting thing to me about angular momentum is in the Summer Olympics, which are the divers, because they do the same thing, but yeah, they can actually, by sticking arms out in different directions, change their rotation axis even, right? So that you can even see them rotating and all of a sudden they start going sideways, right? And then come back. And maybe there in ski jump, you can do this a little bit. So I have to, we'll have to see if I can find some good videos of that. I think you probably can, right? That you're spinning not only fast and slower, but you've actually changed the direction of your spinning, yeah, which is really cool. Yeah.
I think that's what's so fun is, you know, as you start to notice these things and start to kind of understand the concepts, it changes the way you engage with and watch sports. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see it when, again, I also love this, the way the skaters spin. And there was, this was probably 15, 20 years ago, there was a skater from, I think, Sweden. I don't think she ever medaled, but I've never seen anyone spin like she could. It was just the most incredible thing to watch her and the way, as her arms moved up and down, as her body changed, as she shifted her weight, how that just changed the momentum, the speed, the way she was spinning. And it was fascinating to watch.
Yeah. So I remembered one other connection I'll tell you. So, right, I mentioned earlier that, you know, many particle physicists, when they're sort of done, they go off and do stuff in data science or, you know, programming and that sort of thing. So I had a colleague who was a postdoc at the same time as me, and he decided to leave the field and he went to work for, this has been a while, I should find out what he's doing now. He went to work for EA. So if you know EA, right, mm-hmm, the video game company, and he was studying things like, he was focused on ice hockey, right? Collisions. So when there's a lot of collisions in ice hockey, when a puck bounces against something, when somebody checks somebody else, right? When your stick rams into something, and you want in that video game for things to be as accurate as possible. So how do you model that? But you have to model it in a way that's also efficient, that you can program in a computer and then translate that to a video game. So he used a lot of, you know, computational tools he used as a particle physicist, but then went back to the physics 101, and he was helping to create video games, which is a really kind of cool thing.
So that could be another fun thing, is debunking the physics in video games. Do they have an accurate physics engine?
They're pretty accurate.
Some of them, they've gotten so much better.
Yeah. From these accelerators, right? These fancy GPUs that yep, do all these computation. You can do this, a lot of stuff you couldn't, calculations you couldn't do, you know, a decade or two ago. Yeah.
Well, Jared, this has been so much fun, and I am really looking forward to your talk. It'll be after one of our first one when we come back from 2026. So as we kick off the Winter Olympics, I'm looking forward to hearing you talk to us about what we're seeing.
Great. Well, I look forward to it, and thanks for chatting today.
This has been a production of the STEAM Studio. Please make sure you like, subscribe, and leave a review to help others discover our shows. You can listen on platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this STEAM Spotlight. Thank you to our partners, NIU STEAM and Northern Illinois University, for supporting this podcast. If you would like to learn more about the work we do, please check us out online at niusteam.niu.edu. Thank you so much for listening.